At first, it seemed a sharply political issue. You know, Sizwe and I would walk into a treatment center and the waiting room would be full of people, sick, waiting to go onto antiretroviral drugs. And I would say, this is amazing. You know, if without these drugs, these people would be dead or dying, and now they're going to live. And he'd say, it's not amazing, it's humiliating. Here you have a room full of sick people, sick black people, a village full of sick black people, an epidemic that's attacking black people, and they're all queuing, lining up for Western medicine and Western drugs, and it's humiliating. It's yet another round in many, many rounds of cultural and racial defeat. And he set about looking out for an indigenous cure. He wanted to find an Mpondo traditional healer who could cure AIDS. And that was part of a salvaging of his racial dignity.
Was this traditional healing being pushed out by the Western medicine, or is this something that was still practiced in Lisikisiki?
It's strange, I mean, and quite paradoxical. The traditional medicine had both been weakened and yet was flourishing. It had been weakened in the sense that it was once a fairly stable body of knowledge and practice that had dissipated and scrambled over the years. But at the same time, you know, as it scrambled, so many entrepreneurs picked it up. You know, there was a lot of sickness, a lot of dying, and with that, chances for people to stand up and say, I have a cure. My ancestors have visited me in my sleep and have told me where to go for a cure. So I guess traditional medicine was really splintering and fracturing, and lots of people were taking it up, and a lot of them were jokers and trying to make a quick buck. And people are very experimental. People are not sure what works and what doesn't, and they're very experimental. They'll try many things.
Well, I want to go back to Dr. Reuter, because these two figures in the book represent the two clash of cultures. And I think Dr. Reuter has a view that probably many Americans have, that if you provide these medical services, if you provide these antiretroviral drugs, that people will come. Did you see that happening in the village?
To an extent, it certainly happens. You know, Doctors Without Borders arrived to a battered clinic system, you know, which really wasn't working well. The nurses were in denial and saying there's no epidemic here. And within a year, they had a very, very good program set up, and people came to get medicine. By the time I left, it was nearly 2,000 people in this area were on antiretrovirals. So clearly they were doing things right. I think that they did underestimate how difficult it is and how many people don't get it. If you look at the national picture, there are currently about 470,000 South Africans on antiretroviral medicine, but 70% of them are women. Treatment behavior is dividing along gender, and a lot of men are staying at home and dying when treatment is available. And that was happening in Lusikisiki too. I met a lot of men who were sick, who were too ashamed to say why they were sick, although everybody knew it was fairly obvious, and they were staying at home.
Do you get the sense that those cultural or individual or more abstract obstacles are greater than the physical or infrastructure obstacles of clinics and nursing staff and doctors staffing these clinics? I mean, do you get the sense that one is the bigger obstacle than the other?
That's such a difficult question to answer. It's really difficult to know where the one begins and the other ends. Herman's position is that whenever people stay at home, it's because of a bad service. You know, he was quite almost dogmatic in his belief that supply of medicine shapes demand, and if supply is good and is right and is pitched correctly, people will come. And there's certainly something to that. You know, if ARV medicine is as available at ground level as, you know, the preachers who argue that one is cured by praying, then ARVs can compete against preachers. That's right. But at the same time, you can't wish away the fact that the people who need the medicine are human beings, and human beings are complicated and at times mysterious. And you're dealing here with a disease that is sexually transmitted, that couples shame, sex, and with death. And that gets people behaving in strange ways in whatever cultural environment. If it's in Africa, or if it's in America, or if it's a rich person, a poor person, the psychology of this virus is very difficult.
I understand you've been traveling around the United States here the last couple of weeks, the Council of Foreign Relations, the Center for Strategic International Studies. What are the conversations you're having in these, high-profile venues?
I'm struck by how educated and intelligent American audiences have been. I mean, my worry in coming on this tour is that Sizwe and the people around him would seem very exotic, that there'd be a lot of talk about magic and about witchcraft and demons. And people have been very quick to see the universal questions in the story. you know, to simplify things that any receiver of medicine, anybody going on to treatment, is a complex being. And stigma, shame, hiding, concealing, these are questions that medicine faces all around the world.
People in this country who may hear of the work of Doctors Without Borders or hear that the U.S. government has appropriated money for AIDS in Africa or hear about breakthroughs at universities, what do you feel or do you think that they don't understand about what actually is happening?
Well, I think the resources are doing good. And you know, the Bush administration has put aside huge quantities of money to fight the AIDS epidemic in Africa. And, you know, it must be the biggest single transfer of funds from one continent to another to fight a health crisis ever. And it's money well spent. I think, though, that there's a temptation here and in the West generally to believe that Africa can be saved. You know, if you throw medicine, if you throw science, if you throw progress at Africa, it'll be gobbled up and Africa will be saved. And that's a crude way of putting it, but that desire and that wish is embedded in a lot of thinking. It's a myth. I mean, Africa needs a great deal of help, but it can't be saved. You know, an epidemic like this is only really defeated once people find a solution themselves. It's about Africans speaking to one another, engaging in dialogue, and changing the practices that are perpetuating this epidemic. And, you know, that's an outsider can't save you from that. That's something you've got to pick up and do yourself. The help that's coming in is important, but it shouldn't ride on this fantasy of salvation.